Hey yo, what's up? It's Radio Free Nintendo episode 120. This is your host, Jonathan Metz. We have an extra large crew today. Of course, Greg, Lindemann, and James are back. James taking a break from his editing marathon. And we also have special guest, Carl Castañeda.
Hello. Hey guys.
Yes, so we have a five-man show. No females unless, well, never mind. And
except for the bitches
gonna,
on the show.
The night is still young.
Night is still young. Oh, dear. Okay, so, we're going to start with new business. We're going to try to get back into our groove this week. So we're going to have a full show, new business. We'll take a break, come back with DLC Mondays and listener mail on a weekly basis
coming
now.
Coming back at you.
That's right. And then we'll take another break, and we come back with our feature topic today, which is expectations and video games, also known as hype.
Also known as the Peter Molyneux episode.
Yeah, so it should be an interesting topic, and we'll get into that later. So, without further ado, new business. Slight change of how we're going to do this going forward, just to try to keep the length down a little bit. We're going to try to limit ourselves to one or two games apiece, and if we don't have anything specifically new to talk about, we'll just pass and come back next week with something else. So it's no big deal if one of us passes. We're hoping that this segment will flow a little bit better. And as usual, our guest will start us off. So,
oh,
Carl,
okay.
Please
fill
us in.
If you're starting with me, then the show's already fucked. But we'll soldier on anyway. But I've just been playing a few things lately. I've rediscovered the Wii, as it were. Because as things go, I've kind of been flip-flopping back and forth between my main hobby being video games and comic books, as Johnny knows. But lately, I've gotten way back into playing my Wii, and I picked up two games recently. The first one, which I'm going to just go through really quick because, it's been discussed ad nauseum, is Orbient, which I think Johnny's probably discussed a few times on the show. And
it's a fantastic choice, sir.
So fucking great. So fucking good. Play it, buy it, enjoy it, love it. Relish in it.
Everybody who downloads it loves it.
It's fantastic. But it is eerily similar to Pixel Junk Eden.
Really? And of course, it's developed much earlier.
I'm sure.
Originally.
Yeah. I'm not sure Orbital came out a few years earlier.
Yeah.
I'm not placing any blame as far as these people got ripped off or anything. But one of my roommates has a PS3, and so the first thing that happened when we all moved in together was all right, dude, you got to play 6 hours of Pixel Junk Eden. So I played that for a little while, and
on shrooms,
man. So the two games are very, very similar to the point where if you have one, you kind of don't need the other.
Really? What makes them so similar?
You can jump. How does that have anything to do with Orbient?
Okay, well, the whole thing about Orbient is that, you're kind of using gravity and anti-gravity to kind of flow around, but you're basically going almost in a circle when you're around gravity. And so the thing with Pixel Junk Eden is you're using the analog sticks to kind of twist yourself around, spin yourself around, and it's almost similar to that whole gravity aspect, collecting points and then collecting satellites. And as far as gameplay goes, it's a little it's pretty different, but as far as the feeling of playing it, very, very similar. The payoff is very, very similar between the two games.
Okay.
Both great.
Yeah,
both fantastic.
Definitely
both
one
are,
of the first
both
things
playing,
I would.
But just
both
very
are
similar.
Great, but
it's very similar. It's kind of do I want to play? I'm trying to think of two games that are way too similar to have both. I don't know. Just it's like having NBA Live and NBA
Pokemon 09. And Digimon.
Exactly. Well, that's a pretty easy
wrong.
Whatever. But you get what I'm saying. So yeah, if you have one, don't get the other. But yeah, Orbient's great. And the second game that I've been playing a lot of, or at least the second game that I've been dying at a lot, is Mega Man 9, a.k.a. a test in frustration. But it's
hard.
So fucking hard, man. I don't consider myself...
It's the test of testicles.
I by no means consider myself Steven Rodriguez, who can just fucking breeze through anything. If it has buttons, he can play it. But, I've been playing games for a while.
Including women.
I've been playing games for a little while.
Oh.
Hey.
It's I think I should be able to play Mega Man 9, but unfortunately, not so much. It's way too fucking difficult. But I know, Greg, you've been playing it too.
Yeah, I've been playing. See, I had never played a Mega Man game before, actually.
That's still sacrilege, by the way.
I could go into it again because people didn't actually hear it, but I'm not going to because I find it tedious hearing.
Greg has never played a Mega Man game, and yet he is a member of the staff's. Go figure.
You should buy Mega Man 2. It's the best.
Well, now I have played a Mega Man game, and yeah, it was pretty daunting when I first started playing it. You know, it was just like, you know, enemies flying in, dropping stuff that breaks apart, and bottomless pits, yeah. And you can get knocked stunned into the pits, and yeah, I mean, it's really daunting. But I have beaten it now. I've beaten it, and I didn't buy anything from the store. So
I'm very proud of that.
I did use some items that I found in Wily's Fortress, but I didn't actually buy any. So that was kind of the standard I set. And it is hard, and it's hard in some ways that I think are not that great. I mean, some ways the challenge is very good, and it's sort of out of some good design. And some of it is like, let's change the jump physics and then ask you to do stuff that's more challenging than when the physics is normal. Like,
well, that's pretty much standard for that whole franchise, though.
Well, you would know better than I, obviously, but I'm just saying as a comment, yeah. I don't think that's a particularly... I don't think that's a particularly positive... When you're looking at it at a fresh set of eyes rather than simply, I expect this to be in the game, it doesn't strike you as being a particular triumph of game design.
No, it isn't.
But overall, I wouldn't say much bad about the game. I think it's excellent. You know, you don't have to be a Mega Man fan to enjoy it if you just like that kind of general, old-school, challenging kind of game. I think it's fantastic.
And yeah, the music is great.
Since you've now beaten it, as of this week, you can download the hard and super hard modes.
I have downloaded one bit of DLC, which is the Endless Attack mode. The endless attack mode is kind of like Yoshi Touch and Go, which is just...
What?
Well, certain modes of Yoshi Touch and Go, where it's just like... So, it's kind of like this... Are you going to like this, James? A randomly generated element to it.
Ah! Fire bad!
In terms of...
Fuck!
The goal of it is just to go... It counts how many screens you advance... And what it does, it's just like a remix of a bunch of different stuff. But the interesting thing is not a remix of any of the levels that are in the main game. They're all kind of different. But they're all like level elements that have been designed. And it runs the whole gamut, you know, the water stuff, the ice stuff.
That's pretty much every Mega Man level design.
Yeah,
ever.
Apparently there's some nods to literally segments out of past Mega Man 9 games. That's Mega Man 9 games. Jesus Christ, Mega Man games.
Liked Mega Man 9 4.
That Mega Man 9 is the series to me.
Well, it is Capcom. I mean, they could do that.
There will be Mega Man 9X, Mega Man 9 2, and etc.
There's apparently some nods in there to literally bits of previous levels that fans of the series might notice as well. But the weird thing, like, where it's different from Yoshi Touch and Go is, the goal is just,
is that it's hard.
Well, there's that, yeah. I mean, because what happened with Yoshi Touch and Go is it ramps up. Like, it starts off very gentle, and then Yoshi gets faster, and there's more enemies, and it gets crazier and crazier and crazier, and you get more likely to die. And then you'll die. With this, it just starts off ridiculously hard. Like, harder than the stuff that's in the normal game. Instant death spikes everywhere. Slippy, slidey ice blocks that are, like, as wide as you are. Just absolutely...
I love it already.
Satanic level design. And the worst thing is, like, the first times you're playing through it, obviously, it's kind of random and you don't know what order it's going to be. So you can easily just be, like, dropping down a pit down several screens, and then at the end, there's a spike there, you're dead.
Beautiful.
It's a really super hardcore mode, and I think I'm going to get some fun out of it, but it's like, if you have issues with the difficulty of the normal game, probably not going to be a great buy. And I think it's the most expensive piece, 300 points.
Yeah.
By the way, no one is ever allowed to make fun of buying DLC for already downloaded games now. Again, I'm perfectly in the clear from this point on.
Sorry, there's no bikinis involved in this, James.
yet. They've already released two downloadable characters, and they've done things like that before in the series.
There's a lot of potential with Splash Woman.
Yes, exactly.
There you go.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, the last
Carl,
game...
I see that you've been playing Rock Band 2.
I have.
Tell us about that real
quick. That's the last thing I want to talk about. And I'm not going to spend too much time on it again. I've been meaning to get together with Sklens so that we can rock out together. We haven't done that in a while.
Me, dude.
But we haven't gotten around to that yet. But I will say...
Can't you do it online?
Yes.
Oh, we can, but the super fucked up situation is that the way my apartment is set up, like, there's no Ethernet... cord. There's no way I can extend an Ethernet cord from the wall or to the from the router over into my Xbox. And my Xbox is the entertainment center Xbox, even though there are three of them in this fucking house. And so basically,
so get a wireless situation.
Yeah, I really need to shore that up. But anyway, so yeah, that's why
I have a wireless bridge. It works well.
And I really need to look into that. But anyway, I will just say that there is really nothing better than singing "Hungry Like the Wolf" at 3 a.m., drunk off your ass with three roommates. It is sublime. Mm-hmm. And that's all I have to say about that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Bye. So, Greg, what have you been playing other than Mega Man 9?
Yeah, so it's been like a month since I recorded a new business that anyone will hear. So a fair
we
bit
heard
in that
it.
Time. The Mega Man's been quite a lot of it, because beating that is hard work. It is. It requires manual labor.
Yes.
And the disaster impressions went up and nobody read them. So if anybody wishes to read them, they can. But the big thing I've played is The Blob. I've pretty much played through the entire game in that span. And obviously got quite a lot of very good reviews, especially from us, courtesy of Nick DeMola. And I like it. I like the game. It's got I think the defining aspect of it is very laid back. Very sort of chill vibe to it. You've got the dynamic music with the where as you sort of roll along and paint the landscape, different colours sort of activate different instruments, and as more of the landscape is painted, the soundtrack generally gets busier and stuff. So there's this very nice kind of audio-visual experience going on. As a game, the biggest problem I think it has is a lack of variety. Visual variety in the sense that most of the environments look very similar. Gameplay variety in that essentially you're doing very similar kinds of tasks over and over again in a kind of fairly unconstrained way, but that's what it amounts to. So it's not the longest of games, although I'd say the length is kind of fairly satisfying, but what's not so satisfying is what you actually do in that time. It's just
yeah, I saw this at E3 and I asked the developer guys who were demoing it to us, so how does this change in the later levels? Because they kept telling us there are like 8 or 9 levels and it lasts 10 hours. And I'm like, okay, how is hour 10 different from hour 1? Because I couldn't really see how the gameplay evolves and progresses. You know, what do they introduce that makes it different as you go? And they really didn't have an answer for
me. Well, and
that
there isn't a whole lot. I mean, the environments become more complicated and they become slightly more perilous in terms of there are more there's more hazards that could actually kill you. But I never saw a game over screen, and you're not going to in all likelihood unless you're very careless. Because it is a very laid back game. It doesn't really ask many impositions of you. It's kind of like, well, you can do this level very thoroughly if you want, or you can kind of just glide through it, get to the end, and you know, not get a medal or get like these different little achievements and things. It's not a sandbox game literally, but it has a kind of sandboxy feel to it in the sense that it's kind of like, just, you know, muck around, really. Just paint around, and then once you've painted a certain amount of stuff, a gate will open, you can go into the next area and start painting again. I mean, it is very hands-off, and I guess the sort of the intrinsically kind of pleasant aspect of it is what keeps you playing, not the tremendous diversity in the gameplay. And to be fair, if the jumping or the landscape was that much more taxing, then the whole gesture jump thing would become more of a problem.
Right.
So in some ways, you know, you could argue it's merciful that it's not. although they could have just not used the gesture jump equally.
Yeah, you think that.
Yeah. So, but it's a good game. I enjoyed it quite a lot. But I think it's best to have in with some of the praise it's getting. It's probably best for people to have in mind exactly what it is. I think it succeeds better on the level of a audiovisual experience than it does as sort of gameplay.
Yeah. Well, that's refreshing honesty for me, because I've been pretty skeptical of some of the things that I've read about, including Nick's review, because I did play it, and
I felt like they sort of were glazing over some of the very obvious issues with the gameplay because they were so impressed by the audiovisual part, which I agree is pretty nice. But I, and I'm not saying that, you know, it's not worth playing or that, you know, these gameplay problems would keep it from...
I certainly would say that it is, absolutely.
Yeah, I just think you have to acknowledge those things, and I think you have to be kind of straightforward with your criticism of that kind of thing, and that stuff really bothered me.
Johnny, your game sucks Mets.
Also, Diablo probably functioned better as an antidote to Mega Man 9 because you need some relaxing gameplay
time.
Yeah,
it's a good pair.
Cleansing the palate.
After you have a simultaneous kill with a boss and you swear yourself silly, you know.
You know, in the old games, I think it gave you credit when you got a simultaneous.
No, it didn't.
No,
really?
It did. Doesn't with this one.
Remember this way: if you killed the boss and then fell into a pit, you still lost.
Oh, I don't remember any bosses that had pits, but
well, spikes. There was a, what was it?
Yeah.
Iceman had spikes, I believe.
Oh well, Iceman's entire level and the boss himself. Completely evil. That's the first Mega Man for you, though. Moving on, my new business. I've got two games here. Legend of Kage 2. This is a game that I never expected I would be reviewing. It just came up, and we said, hey, we got a copy. Who's going to review it? And I was like, hell, fuck it. I'll do it. And didn't really...
That's the kind of devotion we live for.
Yeah, I didn't know much about it, except, you know, I've heard of the NES game Legend of Kage, which, like, a lot of people think is a big piece of crap. It's on Virtual Console, and the only really famous thing about it is that you can jump really, really high.
Awesome!
That's the only thing that anybody remembers about it, and also that it's apparently not very good. Well, Legend of Kage 2 is for the DS. It looks like a Super Nintendo game, and it pretty much plays like one. You can jump ridiculously high. I mean, the gameplay spans both screens, kind of like Contra 4. Except you don't need a grappling hook in this game. You can actually jump to the top of the top screen. So, wow. And it's on pretty much the same scale as Contra 4. So, I mean, and actually, as you play through the game, your jump gets higher and higher and higher. So it's like, oh my god, you gotta be kidding. But I don't think it's a piece of crap, and I've never really played the original, so I can't say anything about that. But Kage 2 is actually pretty good. Like I said, it feels very much like a lost Super Nintendo game, except it happens to span two screens. So if you're into stuff like Contra 4 or Mega Man 9, sort of like old school experiences, I think it's very, very much fitting in that vein, but it's not as difficult as those games. The bosses can be challenging, but like the stages themselves typically are not really that hard. Most enemies die in one hit. And it kind of feels, I would compare it to Ninja Gaiden, but without as many platforming elements. It's more about just going around and slashing dudes, and it's not like if you get hit, you're going to get knocked back in a pit and die, which is pretty much that's the summation of Ninja Gaiden 1 through 3, right?
Yeah.
And that doesn't really happen in Kage 2. There are no bottomless pits. There are no instant death spikes. So it's much more forgiving, but it feels very much the same. It's a ninja game. You just run from the left to the right and slash dudes as you get to them. And, you know, you have some ninjutsu you can do. And there's some neat little elements to it. But overall, it's very simple, very retro. And apparently it's $20. So, I mean, it's not a super long game and it's not amazing or anything. But for $20, I think it's a nice purchase for people who are into that kind of like old school action thing. And the other game I've been playing is Too Human. I finally got it from GameFly, and you know, I've been waiting 8 years to play this game.
Now, Johnny, you told me that you were going to be playing co-op through that game with Dennis, weren't you?
I'm supposed to. Yeah, he and I have talked about it, but I have not managed to do it yet. I did see him on a couple days ago, but he was busy with something else. So I'm hoping to do that before I send it back. But I'm you know, I'd like to try co-op.
Don't tell him you rented it.
Well, you know, whatever. They still it's sold a copy, public right? Record. They still sold a copy, just not to me.
To GameFly.
Yeah, well, they sold a bunch of copies to GameFly. So, anyway, I think I'm primarily just going to play through it single player. I'm already, like, to the fourth level, which I think is the last, although the levels are pretty big. But I think I'm just going to play through the story, because mainly I wanted to see the story. Like, I knew when I put it on my queue
that, you know, what they changed it into, this whole kind of Diablo kind of action RPG, although it's more RPG than action, I would say.
Definitely.
Loot collecting and, you know, stuff like that. It's not really up my alley. It's not really my kind of game, but I'm still interested in the story. I mean, I love Norse mythology. I love the idea of combining that with cybernetics and this question of, you know, is it better to stay more human or become more of a machine? And, like, you know, there's a lot of gray area there in the middle. And gameplay-wise, the game doesn't handle that stuff very well. I mean, there's a point where you, like, decide if you want to go take the human path or the cybernetic path, but they're practically the same. And story-wise, I don't think it makes any difference. It just, like, changes some skills that you have access to. It's much less ambitious than what they originally planned 10 years ago when they first started.
Isn't that always the way?
Yeah. And it's really a classic, like, Molyneux type of situation where, yeah, you know, it was set forth as this ridiculously ambitious thing, and then they really had to scale it down. I mean, you could maybe say that about Spore also. I haven't really played it, but...
we're going to discuss that later, though.
Yeah, maybe.
Right. We're on the topic of Too Human, I actually did play through the first couple hours of the game,
mm-hmm.
And I have, like, there are very clear problems with it.
Yeah.
They're well documented too. Like, you know, when you die, the whole Valkyrie coming to find you, it takes like 5 minutes to get the whole fucking sequence over with.
You know, I've gone through that enough times that I can honestly say it's really more like 60 seconds. It just feels really long.
It just feels forever. It's like the Resident Evil 4, like you are, or the Resident Evil, it's like you are dead, continue. Like, I'd rather have like some sort of button press or some kind of screen than like seeing this convoluted like cinematic sequence over and over again. It's endlessly frustrating. But yeah, that, and I find the whole experience and the loot thing just kind of like, when you play something like Diablo 2, which is, I think, the best dungeon hack out there. I mean, it feels like can you kind of ease into it? But with Too Human, it just kind of feels like, here's a bunch of shit, figure it out.
Exactly. Yeah, the systems, I mean, you go into the menus and look at the equipment systems, they're incredibly complicated, and the game really has no tutorial. It has no online help to kind of teach you how mm-hmm. to do that stuff. I mean, there are probably levels to the menus than most people look at. And maybe there's stuff in the instruction manual. I don't know, because Gamefly doesn't send you a manual, so I don't really know what's in there. Manuals. But the game really doesn't teach you how to play the game, and mm-hmm. it's so complicated that I feel like it should. You know?
Yeah, I had the same problem with Mass Effect, and Mass Effect is another game. I know everyone loves that game, but I fucking hate it. And I had the same problem with it. I would never play
Mass Effect because of the kind of game it is. I'm just not interested. And the only reason that I am playing Too Human at all is that, you know, I know Dennis. I've been interested in it a long time, and the story fascinates me. But, like, gameplay-wise, this is not my thing. And I'm basically just gritting my teeth through it because I want to see what happens next. I mean, the story overall is pretty interesting, although the writing itself is shit. It really is. I mean, it's like Gears of War 2 with Viking
and accents and accents.
Yeah, it's really bad. So, I mean, the plotting is pretty interesting.
What in-house writing does for you?
Yeah, I mean, the dialogue needs a lot of work. Like, the actual plot is pretty cool, and it could go a lot of interesting places, and I like that. But yeah, the actual script is really crap.
Well, one last thing is, like, I think that, you know, if the story was good or bad, I could take it or leave it. But I think the gameplay has a lot of promise. So I think if they're able to go through with this whole trilogy idea, the second one could be good, and I'd be willing to give it a shot because I think there's a lot of potential there. But as it is, Too Human just feels very much unfinished, which is really embarrassing considering it's been in development for like 12 years.
I agree. I mean, it's like Greg said about Disaster. It feels like it's been through development hell. I mean, it really has that gloss all over it. Like, you go through one part that seems really polished and well done and very cinematic and impressive, and then the next section just looks like ass. I mean, it just looks totally unfinished. You got crazy clipping, and this ally AI character suddenly gets caught behind the door, even though it's pretty obvious that he's not supposed to. And there's just so much... there's so much unevenness, you know, so much inconsistency in the game. And yeah, I totally agree. It feels like they rushed out the door at the last minute because they kind of created a deadline that they had to meet. And yeah, I don't know. I also feel like maybe, I don't know, I feel like Silicon Knights kind of needs a little more guidance maybe. I mean, if you think about Eternal Darkness, where they worked with Nintendo, and then Metal Gear Solid, where they worked with Konami and Nintendo, and then this is their first game in over 5 years, and they've done it pretty much on their own the entire time. And I feel like, you know, for one thing, it's been way too long, and obviously they've changed platforms multiple times, so the technology is all over the place. But yeah, I also feel like at some point they made design decisions that they didn't really think all the way through, and then they got later in the process and realized that it would be too much work to go back and fix them.
But yeah, there's also stuff like the menu designs.
The menus are really clunky. There's some control stuff that's not good, where they get stuck on little surfaces and you have to go around them and stuff like that. I mean, you got this little mini game of killing trolls where you jump up on their back and you have to sway back and forth, and it's the same throughout the entire game. You do it dozens and dozens of times, and it never changes. And it's like, you know, I mean, it's like a God of War type little mini game thing to kill a big enemy. Like, it makes sense, it could be good, but you have to have more than one of those. And it's just so many things that I just wish somebody had slapped them upside the head at some point in the development and said, guys, this isn't good enough. You can do better. And they would have.
Well, there.
So
in the demo, there was a scene where you did that little button press event.
Yeah, the QuickTime event, yeah.
Yeah, and the problem was that in that particular instance, like, you had to jump and then press a button while you were still coming down from your attack. So I'd often, like, nail the button again, and it's the wrong button, and then I get flung against the wall and die.
Yeah, it's all very...
It's got problems.
I mean, and the demo, honestly, is the first hour of the game. So it's not like you're... If you play the demo on 360, it's not like you missed out on any explanation of what to do or what's going on. It's exactly the same. So, yeah, the game just kind of throws you into this really complicated soup of gameplay and stats and weird combos and things, and doesn't explain anything, and some of it, even after you learn how to use it, it's not really useful. So yeah, the game, it needs a lot of polish, and yeah, I'm really hoping that the sequel, if it comes out, can address a lot of this stuff,
because
it could be
in another 20 years.
It could be very, very
cool. One last thing I want to say about it is, when I talked to Sklens about it, he's actually a big fan of it from the last time I talked to him about it, because he described the combat as, like, and these are his words, conducting a symphony, and I find to be very inaccurate.
Pretentious shit.
Yeah. I mean,
it's
interesting.
Clumsy as fuck.
The combat is interesting, how clumsy it feels depends a lot on the stats of your character. And what kind of weapons you're using, because the speed at which you slide around and the kind of combos that you do and how well you can manage a crowd, it depends on what class you chose and what weapons you're using. But when the combat works, it's really cool and it feels good. But then 2 minutes later, it'll feel like shit. Like, it's just very inconsistent. Yes. But anyway, that's too human. I thought it was worth bringing up, because I've written about it for so long, and I'm sure people are interested. I mean, this was at one point a GameCube game, so I'm sure there are a lot of our Nintendo fans who are interested. So, anyway, I hope to try co-op with Dennis before I send it back, but we'll see if that actually happens. And John Linneman is next.
Okay, well, Johnny, I'm sure you can relate to this, but I spent a whole bunch of money on the Virtual Console and WiiWare today.
Billions of dollars.
Billions of dollars. Well, compared to the normal, like, you know, $5 to $10 I spent. I actually went out and spent $36. So that's actually quite a bit of money. Quite a bit of money for the Wii, on WiiWare and Virtual Console. But I picked up Gradius 2 Gopher no Yabu, which is a TurboGrafx-C ROM version of Gradius, and also a great name. Probably the best Gradius name I've ever heard.
Yeah, seriously.
That is a great name.
It means the ambition of Gopher. Is what it translates.
Okay. That makes it even better.
Wow.
Honestly. It makes you think of what is a gopher's ambition in life.
It kind of makes you think of some sort of improbable working girl star rise to power.
Like, go get me a sandwich. You know, that's what I thought. I'm like, gopher, go get me some donuts.
The devil wears Gradius.
Yeah. Having played through pretty much the entire game, I can verify this is, in fact, shockingly not the case.
Oh. Son of a bitch.
Yeah. But, you know, so it's pretty good. So you've played through this whole game?
Pretty much. I got to a brick wall towards the end. I could probably use the Konami code to plow through it, but I just kind of lost interest.
Is it in there?
Go back to it. Yeah, it's in there.
Of course.
I've tested it. I haven't actually gone through any levels with it, but it works.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely pulls no punches in terms of what it throws at you. I mean, it takes you a while. I mean, the way it's designed is, you know, and you know, Johnny... I still have to play Gradius 5. I know that's one of those my ongoing struggle
Gradius
to play 5,
you'll probably find it's a little more forgiving than the rest of the
Yeah,
the
I'd agree with that from what I've played.
Doesn't surprise
it,
me. Yeah, this one's pretty old school. This one, I think this one falls right after, from the intro they have, it seems that it falls right after Life Force.
Yeah, it's kind of, because it's still all in Japanese, like the text, right? So it's, you kind of don't really know what's going on, but just from the artwork that it shows, it's definitely like shows something from the original Gradius and then something from Life Force.
Yep, and it's from 92, so I'm not too sure exactly where.
Although,
like,
obviously, it
would have
came
out
in the arcade sometime before that, presumably. And then
yeah,
this was
I think 88.
Yeah, this is like supposed to be a pretty damn good conversion, but it's very similar to 3 in many ways on the Super NES. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of the level environments are similar with once you play through it all. But it's probably a bit harder. But what it does have is infinite continues. But the thing about that's not always that useful in Gradius, because you could so frequently find yourself like in those really awkward spots where it's like with no speed ups and no weapons, this part of the game is impossible, no matter how many continues I've got.
I mean, that's the thing. That's the way it's designed, is that it's pretty obvious from the outset that the process of playing the game is that, you know, you play through an entire stage and pretty much learn it well enough in order to get to the boss completely powered up. In other words, you just basically have to learn it over and over and over again, because there's a lot of places. I mean, even in the first stage, I'm just like, okay, it's a real pain in the ass if I get killed anywhere because I start off with nothing.
And
they'll give you like the 2 token, you know, power ups, but that's like, you know, you boost your speed and you like, you know, get like 2 missiles, like extra missiles every time you shoot, which is nothing against some of the bosses, I'm sure. So,
well, people might make fun of me, but I had Gradius 3 growing up, and I pretty much always played it with a Konami code, just like I did Contra. So, I mean, for me, it wasn't about like trying to get a high score or trying to challenge myself to get through the game. Normally, for me, it was like, can I, even with the code, can I get to the end of it? Can I see all the cool bosses? And for me, it was worth it, because if I had never used that code, I probably would have never experienced half the game. I could see that,
and that's the thing. I mean, people may very well find that useful in this one, because it is a little. I'd say it's harder than 3, personally. Although it's pretty similar, and it runs faster, which probably makes it harder. Actually,
right, 3 had all this really helpful slowdown.
Yes.
I think the bubble stage plays at about three frames per second.
Yeah,
I can imagine.
So,
Greg, does Gradius 3, does it let you to go up and down as well as left and right? I mean, because this one, there's, like, even in the first stage, you know, you'll go, you're trying to avoid these blazing suns.
Yeah.
So you have you can't go around them, you have to go under them.
That one doesn't just scroll along the same sort of panel. You can actually sort of go up and down a bit. It's a similar bit in Gradius 5. With the suns and all that, sort of a reprise. But most of the stages are more orthodox. They're just, you know, on the same sort of panel, horizontally scrolling, most of them. That first one's a bit weirder.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, I mean, it seems like the playfield is about 3 screens high.
Yeah,
and you can
that's right. Most of the time it's the standard 1 screen. I think that maybe a bit more like Life Force? I've never played Life Force, but does that have, like, because that has
probably vertically bits,
and then the horizontal bits are a bit different or something, I don't know.
So I'm enjoying that, and the other game I got is Tetris Party. I got World of Goo also, by the way, but I know Johnny's already put up his review.
I didn't review it.
I'm
Nick,
not too sure
Nick
if we
did,
talked about
but,
it.
I love World of Goo. I'm in World 4 now, which is like probably the last chapter. There's an epilogue, but World of Goo is fucking fantastic.
Yeah, don't forget, I'm going to be subsidizing your enjoyment of that.
because it's a real shame.
It's a retail game in Europe.
See, I don't understand that.
Honestly, it would live up. It would live up to a retail release. What that means is it's a ridiculous value on WiiWare. For $15, it's mind-blowingly good and awesome. I still think even if you have to pay $40 for it, I would say it's probably worth it. But if you can get it for 15,
we'll see what
15.
Price they set it at, and we'll also see, like, supposedly there's going to be some extra content, and it'd be interesting how much. But yeah, basically they needed money to help finish it, so they sold the rights to publish it as a retail game in Europe to, I think, DTL Publishing or something. Yeah. And so that helped fund the project.
I've never heard of DTL Publishing.
Neither have I, but until now. But yeah, there is an upside. I'm not going to have to clear 300 blocks off my Wii. I'm not sure how much I paid for that privilege, but
definitely I had to do that. I mean, right now on my Wii, I have like honestly, I have 5 games, and my Wii is entirely full.
I mean, it's crazy. Even Gradius is 220 blocks because it's CD.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's a squeeze.
Yep. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to playing World of Goo. What really put me over the edge with that one? I mean, what made me actually go out and buy it was the fact that I looked on Metacritic. I was looking for some other reviews for some other games, and I checked the Wii scores just for kicks, and that's actually the second highest rated game on the Wii, behind Mario. It's like, and that's what actually with quite a number of reviews too. Like every single review is 95 or above.
Is that after Galaxy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like I think its score is like 97, and World of Goo is like 96, or like something like that. It's like 1 point behind Mario Galaxy.
Well, I mean, I think Neil just wrote this blog post about World of Goo and compared it to Braid, and I agree in the respect of it being very artistic and like being a really unusual quality for a game, for a download game. The main difference is World of Goo is not pretentious whatsoever. It's actually just really funny and straightforward with its humor. And
I don't really think Braid is either. I mean,
I like
Braid.
Braid's
kind of like a fairy tale.
I mean, but it is fucking pretentious. The story is
dude. They made
so
Braid
over the
for
top.
Evan Birchfield.
I guess the story in Braid, I have
a lot of problems with the way that it's presented and the attitude of it, but the game I love. It's just World of Goo, you get this great game, but also the story, it like doesn't take itself super seriously, but it's actually funny and interesting. So and it's very mysterious. Like the story
super
kind of
serious.
Reveals itself in a weird way as you play through. Anyway, yeah. But what about Tetris Party?
Tetris Party. Yeah, if you like Tetris, Tetris Party is...
And you like parties.
And you like parties. And you know how we like to party at RFN.
Party!
Like, so, yeah. I mean, it's amazing. That's really all I can say. I mean, much like World of Goo, I mean, this is another game where if you can clear out the fridge, definitely get it because it has, I mean, excellent online. I mean, it has, I think, 5 different single-player modes, 7 different multiplayer modes.
Is the online like Tetranet, where you have like Mario Kart kind of attacks that you send over and
No, it's strictly blocks from what I can see. The thing is I haven't played enough. I know that you can
strictly blocks.
Well, the thing is you can send items over, but I haven't played a game with that enabled, so I don't know exactly what that entails.
Okay.
But I know that you do. There are items. So
and have you tried the balance board mode?
No, I don't have Wii Fit.
No. Oh, okay.
But yeah, I'd be interested to see what that entails too.
Well, I just got Wii Fit, so I'm looking forward to trying that mode in Tetris Party later in the week.
Yeah. I mean, much like World of Goo, it's another one of those WiiWare games where you're like, they could easily sell this as a retail game. I mean, there's so much content in it. I mean, it's so much content, so polished. And I mean, it has, you know, 4-player. I don't know if you can play 4-player online. I don't know. There's a lot there. It's not just something where, you know, you pop it in and you can, you know, go through it and even like, you know, 20 minutes. I mean, there's just so much stuff there. I'm still figuring out exactly all of what you can do. But it's really, really good.
Cool.
So I highly recommend it.
So, James, did you have anything you want to talk about?
Not really.
Okay.
Been too busy to really do much gaming the last couple weeks.
Yeah, you've been editing like crazy and working also, so... Yeah, I'm glad you could be on the show tonight. We didn't think you'd be able to. So we're glad to have you here, and we'll get you more involved in the next segment. But make sure you play something for next week, okay?
Yeah.
All right. For real, dude. Like, come on. Come on.
Seriously. James, Christ.
Quit your job if you have to.
What's the matter, James? Is Ace Combat not striking your fancy anymore?
Dude, it's just that we don't want to hear about it anymore.
No, I've still played that game.
Just had to say
I still play that in Call of Duty 4 from time to time.
Yeah, Call of Duty I'd like to get back into. I've been playing a little Burnout lately and actually started to finally get that, get into it.
You're getting burned out on Burnout?
No, I just didn't. Paradise just didn't click with me when I first... I picked it up when it was $20, you know, when they first dropped it to 20, and I was like, oh, why not? And I like the other Burnouts, but Paradise didn't click with me at first, and I kind of just put it down very quickly. But I picked it back up when the Burnout Bikes thing came out, and I didn't really actually play with the bikes because I don't really like the bikes, but I started playing just the main game and finally figured out a few things about it and started to get in the groove of it and would like end up playing it for like 4 hours at a time.
So yeah, if you put some time into it, you're like, wow, this game is really freaking good.
It definitely takes a while to get used to, that's for sure.
Yeah.
If you play Burnout Paradise with people who have the bikes, can you play with them?
I don't think you can race cars against bikes online. Because
I would just like to slam the bikes into the side.
I haven't really played it online, honestly. I don't think I've taken it online once.
See, I think they're really missing out if they don't let you just cram bikes into the side of the road with your truck.
Yeah, you can, but the bikes don't really deform the same way that the cars do, which is sad.
No, because it'd be the people
deforming. It's still a free update. It's cool. It's so they can get you in there to look at more Burger King and Obama billboards. So, all right. Well, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with DLC Mondays and Listener Mail.
Word.
DLC Mondays. So this week we've already talked about a couple of these games. It won't take long here. But yeah, Tetris Party for WiiWare, that's 1,200 points. Has like 12 or 13 modes. Seems like a pretty full-featured Tetris thing. So there you go. A lot of good reviews on that one. There's also another WiiWare game called The Incredible Maze. I think this is 500 points. And it's basically... Labyrinth, as in like the wooden maze game, you know. So it's very similar to Super Monkey Ball or Kororinpa Marble, whatchamacallit,
Madness,
or actually it's very similar to the balance game in Wii Fit, where you're trying to get the balls in the holes. You know, it's basically the same thing, but you have this maze and a ball, and you tilt the maze around. And interesting thing is, it can be played with either the Wii Remote tilting or the balance board. So yeah, it's only $5. It might be worth it. I don't know. It seems pretty straightforward, very simple. For Virtual Console, we have two import TurboGrafx games. First, the CD game that John talked about, Gradius 2. That's 900 points. And then also a sports game. This is Digital Champ Battle Boxer.
Digital?
For 700 Champ points. Champ
Battle Boxer.
Yeah, it sounds like a Punch-Out clone. Of unknown quality, but yeah, it's a boxing game, and you know, there aren't that many boxing games out there.
There's a big one coming, so it's F this game.
There's a big one coming next year for $50. Yeah, this is 700 points, so I mean, if you're into the whole Punch-Out thing, it might be interesting. I have no idea.
But yeah, that's it. So another import week. It's always nice to see those, and pretty good WiiWare stuff too this week. All right, listener mail. we're going to try to do this on a weekly basis, as I mentioned last week. These questions that we're doing today, we actually did about 3 weeks ago, and they were lost. So we're going to redo them right now, and then next week we'll start with new questions, which you can send to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we implore you to do so. And also, I'd make a note, try to keep your email fairly short, because the longer they get, the more I have to edit them down. We just can't be sitting here and like reading out verbatim four paragraphs of your rant on something. So try to keep it a little shorter, because it just works better that way on radio. All right, so Greg has the first email.
Yes, I do. This is from Adam, and he writes, you guys will do new business or just a discussion about a game, and you mention the name of the game at the beginning of your discussion, but often never again. Then you will talk about it for 10 minutes. If you could just say the actual name of the game instead of this game, it would be a big help. So,
fuck you, Adam.
There you go.
Good suggestion.
You know
there,
what's funny?
And,
we read this question 3 weeks ago, so in theory, we should have been doing it starting this week.
Yeah, how that works.
I don't know. It remains to be seen, but I don't think we did too bad of a job of it today. For one thing, we didn't really talk about any game for 10 minutes.
There you go.
So that helps. We had a kind of, we moved more briskly. But I completely agree. I used to have this problem listening to One Up Yours when I first started. Well, the other thing was I had trouble keeping track of who was talking because I didn't know their voices that well yet. But we're not going to keep saying, you know, like, oh, this is Johnny, I'm saying this, you know, we're not gonna do that. You're just gonna have to deal with that. But as far as the game titles, yeah, we'll try to be a little more on top of that, because I totally agree.
Thank you, Johnny. Right.
Thank you, Johnny, talking about the letter written to us by Adam. There we go,
said James confused.
See,
yeah, there you go. Okay, the next email is from Austin. With Super Mario RPG recently hitting Virtual Console, Secret of Mana releasing in Japan, now in America as well, what do you see for the future of Square Enix on the VC? What about some of their other properties that they don't seem to care about anymore, like the incredible Ogre Battle 64 or Illusion of Gaia? What about the future of Square on Wii, with FF Crystal Bearers looking more in trouble with each passing month? And we should say, actually, this was written before the new Crystal Chronicles Echoes of Time game was revealed, so we kind of know what they're doing with Wii and DS right now, and Crystal Bearers may have been canceled. At the very least, it's not coming out soon, because they're probably not going to announce it. If they announce it at all, they're probably not going to say anything until after Echoes of Time comes out.
Right.
But I don't know, what do you guys think about other Square Enix stuff on Virtual Console? What
Final
is
Fantasy
likely
will never
and what's
come out.
Totally impossible?
Final Fantasy is never going to come out. Neither is Dragon Quest. Don't hope for it, because it's not coming.
Nope. Final Fantasy America.
And all probably agree on that.
Yeah, maybe. Ogre Battle 64, Illusion of Gaia. Maybe.
Ogre Battle 64 is not coming.
Really?
No.
Why do you say so?
Because Square wasn't really involved with that game's creation. They bought the company that made it after the fact.
Enix already owned that company.
Yeah.
Enix wasn't really involved with its creation either. It was a Nintendo-funded affair.
Yes, Nintendo published it. And Nintendo, if it comes out in America, it'll probably be Nintendo's decision.
But the other issue is that game...
Actually, they published it in Japan as
well.
Game, so I think Nintendo would pretty much call the shot on that.
That game is notorious for being very weird on the N64 hardware. It
had a huge cartridge.
Yeah, it sort of used... It was a huge cartridge. I think when I bought it was like $79.99. Mm-hmm. Or something insane like that. And it's totally worth it. Amazing game. Absolutely stunning.
Overrated.
You're wrong.
In my opinion. Just,
on a more fundamental level, the fact that it is an N64 game kind of mitigates against its coming out.
Ever.
They're not really releasing them at a good clip, are they?
No, and that one is far back on the list, because 8 people own a copy of it, and I'm one of them.
All I'll say is, you know, if you look at something like Ogre Battle 64, I think it has just as much of a chance of coming out as something like ActRaiser had of coming out.
But no, ActRaiser would
be a
lot
easier. I'm with
Carl
on this. I think it's totally... I mean, I think any Square Enix game, it's hard to say that, yes, it's probably coming out, because they've been pretty spotty. But I think it has just as good of a chance as anything that else, game, basically. Yeah, other than, obviously, Final Fantasy Dragon Quest. Actually, Final Fantasy Mystic Quest might come out.
That's what I was...
Because they're not going to be... They're not going to be.
That was the Final Fantasy America I was referencing. Exactly, yeah. That was what it was disparagingly called in Japan.
Okay.
It was...
I actually think Mystic Quest is really brutalized unfairly. It's not...
A good game.
It's not a real Final Fantasy game. But it's fun, you know. For a cheaper version of Final Fantasy, it's more for younger players. But I think it's okay, actually.
Well, no, it was more for because Square didn't think Americans were ready for a true hardcore RPG.
Well, that doesn't make sense since they'd already released Final Fantasy IV, and then they later released Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah, it's true, but that's the motivating factor behind it.
That doesn't make any. That sounds like mythology. Sorry, but yeah, Mystic Quest. I don't know if I would pay for it if it came out here, but I think it's not a terrible game. I think it's fun, and this is coming from a guy who played all the Final Fantasies that came to America. So it's not like I'm, you know, it's not like I was a total RPG noob or anything. But I appreciate it for what it was, you know. Anyway, sure. Illusion of Gaia I think is a very strong candidate for Virtual Console. It's a great game. Great game, and it was fairly popular in America. It's well remembered. It's one of my favorite Super Nintendo games, period. It has a really interesting story and a really interesting world that's not really like anything else in RPGs, and it plays a lot like sort of a Zelda, you know? Really nice graphics, great music. It's badass. It's great. And then, of course, the prequel to that was Soul Blazer, which is not as well known in America. I'm not even sure if it came out in America. That one is probably a good candidate also, if it's at least if it's been translated before. And then Terranigma is, I'd say, a very strong possibility. That's the Europe-only sequel to Illusion of Gaia. Yeah, and I've played that through various means, and Terranigma is really good. It's like a very late Super Nintendo game, nice graphics, interesting gameplay. So, yeah. Yeah, I think those games are good. I mean, we're kind of, you know, if you can stay away from the Final Fantasies and the Dragon Quest, I'd say pretty much everything else is fair game, and it's just a matter of what they think will be, you know, what they think has the best sales potential. Even ActRaiser 2 might come out one day, even though it's kind of... It's not a bad game.
No, ActRaiser 2
is bad. I own it somewhere, and it's not a bad game. It's just... It is Mega Man 9 levels of hard, and unfortunately, it kind of drops the best part of the first ActRaiser, so it's only action, and the action is better than in the first ActRaiser, but it's not nearly as interesting without the simulation part. But it's still, game, it's good. It's very beautiful, and it's really, really fucking hard. But it's good.
Yeah, I mean, they basically took what it was and turned it into Castlevania.
Yeah,
essentially.
That's actually a pretty good comparison, yeah.
And the problem is, it's not as good as Castlevania.
No, it's not. But it's not bad. It's not crap, as you say.
I think it's crap based on just by what they did to the brand, it becomes crap.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And I still look forward to ActRaiser 3 one day, which will go back to the simulation stuff. Hey, you know, on DS, it could happen.
Hey, if Knights 2 can come
Johnny,
out...
Johnny, Soul Blazer did come out in the US, by the way.
Okay, so yeah, that's a very good candidate also, I would say.
John, Soul Blazer expert, Lindbergh.
Wikipedia, yes. Brother.
that trilogy of Soul Blazer, Illusion of Gaia, and Terranigma, they're not really sequels of each other. They're all very loosely related. But there are a couple characters and themes that carry over from one game to the other. I've never played Soul Blazer, so I definitely want to check that out if it ever comes out. All right, so Lindemann, please read the next question.
Let's see. Sophia writes, I have been a bit confused as to what version of Guitar Hero World Tour to get. To begin, I had the 360 version pre-ordered, but after looking at some of the bonus features for Wii and having hope for Nintendo-centric songs in the future, I switched over. Besides visuals, is there any discernible difference that would make the 360 or PS3 version the better option, besides having to clean your fridge?
DLC, seriously, come on now. That's...
I would.
What are you talking about, Carl? The DLC is
going to have DLC.
It will
have DLC, but think about it. Would you rather have to, you know, do the whole cleaning out the fridge option, or would you rather just have a hard drive?
Yeah. Like, well, no, it plays off the SD card,
but what it needs like 200 blocks worth of free space to cache stuff.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
There is still
going to
be a storage impeding
dilemma. So you're saying, and make sure I'm hearing you right, Excite Truck still better than this game?
No. What we're saying is that, yes, Guitar Hero, if you want to use DLC songs on Guitar Hero for Wii, it's going to take like 200 blocks, but that 200 blocks will cover an unlimited amount of DLC that you want to download to your SD card. Mm-hmm. So it'll never balloon beyond that on your Wii system memory. And that's pretty good. You know, 200 blocks is not that much compared to a lot of other
stuff. How many blocks
are
there on the Wii?
100, I guess. Around there?
No, I think if you delete everything except the disc channel, basically, it comes out to like 1,500.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Well, even but how would I, the DLC aside, I think that if, you know, I don't know what Sophia's, you know, sound system situation is, but there is actually a really discernible difference between, like, Dolby Digital and ProLogic 2. I mean, if you are, like, you know, an audio whore in that way, then it would make a difference. But if you're not, then really, who cares? Also, yeah, I don't know, I mean, what these is it. Are they going to have a repeat of the whole Guitar Hero 3 scenario, where is it going to be in mono, or are they going to make it stereo?
I'm sure they're going to fix that this time.
Yeah,
yeah.
The other thing I would say, though, is that the internet experience could be. I mean, they'll both be online, but
yeah, if you have Xbox experience. Live, and I know Sophia does, if you have Xbox Live, it may be better to get the Xbox version because all your friends will be on there. But I think more people on Xbox will probably be playing Rock Band, whereas the Wii version of, well, on for Guitar Hero, the Wii version of Guitar Hero is so dramatically better than the Wii version of Rock Band 2.
Is it?
For various reasons. Yeah, I mean, Rock Band 2 is closer to Guitar Hero this time. I mean, they've made a lot of improvement. It does have DLC, but there's no paging file, so you literally have to swap things out manually. So you can only have like 10 songs at a time from DLC.
Oh, that's gross.
Lame.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, if you're primarily interested in playing with other Wii owners, then you should probably get the Wii version. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, the other part of her question, as far as like hoping for Nintendo-centric songs, I mean, I guess that's a possibility for DLC, but also, you know, with the music editor, a lot of people will be making Nintendo songs in the music editor. The question and the thing that we don't really know is whether you'll be able to download and play songs that were created on a different platform. You know, if we don't know if the GH Tunes store is sort of agnostic.
I doubt it.
It probably isn't. It probably isn't.
We don't know. I mean, I can't think of any really strong reason why it should be exclusive per platform, unless it's some kind of artificial constraint by Microsoft.
That's probably
so,
what it is.
I don't.
Yeah,
we just don't know.
I would say so. Yeah. I think all three companies really want to have control over exactly what goes on to their console. You know what I mean? They don't want. I know. I mean, they're just very anal about it. They don't want anything coming in from the outside. Essentially, like they want to be able to say, "Yep, I know exactly what's going to be on here. I've approved it. Send it out." So I just don't think you will ever.
Yeah,
see
but
anything
in the case of Guitar
three.
Hero, I don't think they're really going to be able to approve it anyway.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, yeah, you're probably right. They're probably going to be separated, and in that case, you'd probably want the Wii version because Nintendo fans are more likely to make Nintendo music. But we don't know for 100%.
But didn't they say they were going to be very aggressive about copyright stuff too?
Yeah, I mean, to what extent they can.
Yeah,
but,
so,
you know,
I mean,
if you make the Super Mario Brothers theme and you name it Fire Hot Shit, then
yeah,
how are they going to know? How are they going to screen that?
Because they're going to look at something, why the hell is this called Fire Hot Shit?
Well, you know. Yeah. There'll be all these code names, and there'll be websites where you can translate the name that's on the store to the name of the real song.
They'll bleat speak and all that kind of stuff.
I think you're going way too much into Enigma code here.
I don't know.
You're obviously part of the conspiracy, James.
Uh-huh. We can't stop the signal.
James, please read the last question for today.
All right. So Smackian writes, I know this is probably way out there, but what would you think of Nintendo going the third pillar route again and introducing another platform while still supporting the Wii and DS? Only this time, it's a high-end home console aimed squarely at gamers who want 60-hour big-budget titles, leaving the Wii to focus on the budget casual crowd that already rules it with an iron fist. Doing this nice fantasy, though hypothetically, it would give a good reason why none of their core game development resources have been working on the Wii.
Smackin, you seem like a nice guy, but that's retarded.
Yeah.
Like, that is never going to happen.
I think what's been shown in the last, 2 weeks now?
Yeah. They have stuff. They have sort core of, games coming to Wii. It doesn't matter. They're fine.
Sort of dates this question. Yeah.
Well, the other thing is, and I said this the last time we tried to record this part, is that the third pillar strategy, number one, was bullshit from the beginning. It was just marketing speak. Mm-hmm. Number two, the idea of releasing a third kind of bridge system and not immediately canceling the previous handheld was done because they weren't sure if it was going to work. And it was done because the Game Boy Advance wasn't selling as well as they were hoping. The sales were slowing down. They were trying to do something to kick it off and do something, you know, they're trying to reinvigorate their business. And also, they didn't, the whole, you know, also with GameCube, they were coming from a pretty weak position, where GameCube was not a runaway success. So now with the Wii and the DS, they have both of the two dominant platforms. In fact, not only is DS the most dominant handheld, it's the most dominant platform of all. So Nintendo is completely ruling the industry right now. They have no reason to upset things like this.
Yeah, and also it would confuse. I mean, to have a third, like a second console, or really a third anything, any sort of pillar, it would just completely confuse their kind of marketing spin. Because right now they're like, oh, well, you like Nintendo. Nintendo means this.
Yeah, exactly.
And
you'd be diluting the brand.
Exactly.
And, yeah, I think they like to be very careful. Yeah. And we've seen them get a little more confident with segmenting the market with Wii Motion Plus and some of the stuff that DSi is going to do.
That remains to be seen if that's a wise choice.
Yeah, so, I mean, but I think there's a pretty big gap between that and another third pillar type thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't think that's on the cards at all. But slightly aside here, it's still a reference of what the hell a lot of their internal teams are actually doing. Because Next Level are doing Punch Out, and obviously Treasure are doing Sin of Punishment, and all. It's still kind of like, what are they doing?
Yeah.
We know they're making Wii Sports Resort. Zelda and Pikmin. But I think we're just in a.
Iguchi's
guys are doing like Animal Crossing and Wii Music and Wii Sports Resort. So it's,
They're busy.
I guess you could just say, well, EAD Tokyo are doing another Mario, and the so-called Zelda team are doing another Zelda, and maybe.
We don't know what Retro is doing. So there are a lot of unanswered questions.
I'm holding out hope that EAD Tokyo is actually working secretly on the next Pikmin game.
Yeah,
I hope they're making some kind of follow-up to Donkey... I hope they're making the next Donkey Kong game. Not necessarily a sequel to Jungle Beat.
Jungle Beat, but just like a Donkey Kong game.
I would love, like, a new good Donkey Kong game, because, you know, a lot of people will say that there hasn't been a good Donkey Kong game since Super Nintendo, but, I mean, those people haven't played Jungle Beat.
Jungle Beat's fun. A lot of fun.
No, it's great.
I think it's brilliant. But I feel like it doesn't completely capture the core of Donkey Kong. I'm not sure if there is a core of Donkey Kong.
Well, he does get to rip tongues out of things, which is more like the spirit of King Kong, actually.
Yes.
I guess what I'm saying is I'm really excited for whatever the Tokyo Studio is doing next, whatever it is. But yeah, Pikmin would be pretty interesting if they're taking it on, because as I said last week, I mean, the next Pikmin 3 is going to have to be quite different from the first two to set itself aside now that they're remaking the first two.
The second one, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's going to be
I have no reason to believe it won't be.
Right. And, we have no idea what NST in Seattle is doing.
Yeah.
No.
The last game they were working on is Project Hammer, which apparently went on and on and on for a really long time, and they finally canceled it. So what the hell they made bunches. They made Wave Race and 1080 for GameCube, and a lot of GBA games.
Mario versus Donkey Kong, Metro Hunters.
What the hell are they doing now? I mean, Hunters is the last game I can think of that they made.
Yeah. I thought they did.
Might have done Mario versus Donkey Kong 2.
They probably did that.
Yeah, they did not do the pinball game.
The pinball game was somebody else. In England. English studio. Yeah, okay. I would love another pinball game from Fuse.
Oh, yeah.
NST is a pretty large studio, and NST is a pretty large studio, and we haven't seen much at all from them in years, so that's kind of a weird situation, too. There's definitely a lot of studios that have gone quiet, and it'll be interesting to see. I think maybe around E3 we'll find out kind of more, because it's been, you know, after
Mario Kart and Zelda and Mario and all that stuff came out, Smash Brothers, that was a lot of first-party sort of core development stuff, and then
well, we're definitely in the lull. Smash Brothers wasn't really internal at all, though. It was like Game Arts and like
Sakurai
and all that.
It was a team they built.
Yeah, that was kind of purpose-built, so it wasn't really any of their internal guys. That's kind of the point, is that you know, when you take that out, what have they been doing for quite a while?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we do know that they're making the new WarioWare for DS, the create-your-own microgame stuff.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's, well, I can't think of their names right now, but the, you know, there's some pretty core Nintendo developer guys, you know, including guys who worked on Zelda and Metroid and stuff like that. They work on those games.
Well, Intelligent Systems, I don't know whether they've done some of the WarioWare, haven't they? And presumably they did the new Rhythm Tengoku, because they did the first one, but
oh yeah, maybe that's what they've been up to. But their last Wii game was Super Paper Mario, so they might be involved with the Fire Emblem DS remake.
Yeah, Shadow Dragon.
Now
this is slightly outside of you know internal, but isn't Innis doing something for Nintendo now too? I thought I heard something from them out of TGS.
No, not out of TGS. They probably are, but right now they're primarily making that Lips game for Microsoft.
Okay, I heard something about them from Nintendo, I don't know.
And they're a small studio, so they probably do one game at a time.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's the end of listener mail. Like I said, please keep your questions coming, and we're going to take one more break and be back with our feature topic. Back for the third part of the show, and it's about expectations and video games. And since this was sort of the brainchild of Mr. Greg Leahy, I'm going to let him take over here and explain what this is all about.
Yeah, so some weeks ago, actually, when sort of Too Human was coming out, and you were hoping to get it from Gamefly, and here we are. So basically, this has been on the back burner for quite a while. But now that you have actually managed to play it, we've discussed it a little, it's kind of appropriate, but obviously it's not specific to Too Human that much, but it'll kind of help sort of as an exemplar for what we're going to talk about here. Because the idea is just that how much does you know, sort of the kind of mental baggage that you bring to an experience actually affect how you enjoy it? And that obviously is in the form of expectations, and that can be in a number of different ways. I mean, the first thing we're going to sort of touch upon is, like, hype, the hype element, in terms of well, when I say hype, I mean specifically, like, literally the assertions that come straight from the mouth of developers, like, you know, James' favorite guy, Molyneux, right? You know, right.
Fucker. French fucker.
He's actually British.
Yes.
Whatever.
Dear me. Anyway.
There's no alliteration in that.
Yeah, good point. That is quite well put. But yeah, so yeah, people, but and obviously you're more sort of also you're more old school kind of hyperbole, like you know, sort of Donkey Kong Country or the Sega Genesis commercials or you know any of that sort of.
Blast process.
John Romero is gonna make you his bitch for Daikatana. Remember that one?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. He certainly did. If you went and played it.
Yeah. Seriously.
Promise delivered.
Yeah. So, well, I guess the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Johnny, like, to what extent do you think hype, like, actually works these days, like, in the more sort of sophisticated gaming media of today? And, like, to what extent then does it affect, like, if people get really stoked for a game, do they actually get, like, a self-fulfilling prophecy of, like, I believe this game is going to be great, I play it, it is great no matter what, or do they actually get a nasty shock when they play it? What do you think?
I think there is an element of people who basically convince themselves that they're enjoying a game because they got so excited. Mm. I think it can also have a very negative effect, and you saw this with Too Human, where a game is hyped for various reasons, usually from the developer making comments and interviews and presentations and things, or even on message boards in Dennis Dyack's case.
Troll.
Yeah, you build up this hype about what the game could be or what people expect it to be, and then once the press gets their hands on it and they start to, you know, like real people start to play it, and they come out with some pretty serious criticisms of what it is, it can deflate that hype and create a really negative backlash.
Yeah, the counter hype.
So even point. Yeah, and that's basically what you saw with Too Human, is the counter hype became so flagrant and nasty that people were basically deciding that they hated the game a month before it came out. None of these people had even touched it. This was even before the demo. And Dennis sort of tried to expose that on Gaff, although he did it in a really poor way, I think.
He did
have a valid point, to the extent that, yeah, it is silly to make up your mind about whether a game is good or bad, especially on the extreme ends of that scale, when you haven't even played it yet. I mean, really, what do you have to go on? Maybe someone's word who you may or may not trust, you know, on the internet, looking at screenshots, which may be totally out of context, and a bunch of marketing speak, you know?
Well, so, Johnny, I mean, but in that case, can you even trust reviews?
I mean, in the case of a review, at least you have someone with a less vested interest in the game. And whether, you know, as a reviewer, terms of my review, I don't care if the game's good or bad. I'm getting a review out of it either way. That's the important part. If my assignment is write a review, I'm going to accomplish that whether it's good or bad. So, I mean, as a gamer, I may want it to be good, or I may want it to be bad in some weird cases. At least a gamer isn't involved with the development process. You know, I mean, when you have Dennis claiming that Too Human is the best game Silicon Knights has ever made, and he's so proud of it, and he just can't believe some of these review scores that are coming out, well, that's because he's been buried in it for 5 years, and he has no sense of perspective. And I'm not saying it's a bad game, but yeah, of course he thinks it's amazing. He has to. You know, like, his livelihood depends on that game selling well, and so he's going to talk about it in that sense. So yeah, I think reviewers are inherently much more trustworthy than what a developer or a publisher or a PR person says. Absolutely. I mean, obviously, ultimately, you have to trust yourself. And the best way to decide whether a game is good or not is to play it thoroughly yourself and make up your own mind. But yeah, reviewers do serve a very significant purpose in that they play a lot more games than the average person has access to, and they can sort of guide you and give you information about a game that you may not
you know, be able to play mm-hmm. yourself.
You know, at least make comparisons.
Yeah, I do think reviewers are generally trustworthy. Absolutely. Well, this I've never known anybody who worked at our site who wasn't, and that's 40 people, upwards of 40, 50 people.
Well, it's interesting. I think there's a separation between trustworthiness in somewhat sense and still being somehow susceptible to expectations, maybe skewing a review. I mean, I think this went on a lot more many years ago, but. You know, I think there have been cases where games have been overrated, essentially, because there were, you know, across a reasonable spectrum of reviews, because there were certain things attached to it. Like, I still think, you know, the first Donkey Kong Country got very, very, very positive reviews based largely on its graphics. Which is just, you know, that's not really serving the consumer that well, in my opinion.
I think Grand Theft Auto 4 was overrated.
Well, the people.
I kind of agree, having played it quite a bit. Well. Yeah.
But so,
I think sometimes you even have the opposite effect, where you can have a game that you have reviewers who are trying to send a message with their review, or at least there's the impression of that. Whether that actually happened in the writer's mind, we can't know. But I would point out maybe Jen Sal's review of Wii Music on 1UP, where she gave it an A-, and I can almost guarantee that is the highest review that game will ever get. Now, I'm not saying she's being dishonest about it, but it could be that she was so fed up with the negative hype about this game from people who never even played it before. Okay, that maybe she went into it basically saying, I'm going to find the fun in this game. I'm going to find the upside of this, and I'm going to convince people that there's something worthwhile here.
Yeah, look at it a different
all
way.
It's very good to have multiple perspectives.
Yeah.
But when you go in with an agenda like that, it can artificially skew
the
result.
I think there's definitely cases of that on the negative side. I mean, this is from the film industry, but I remember once reading in a newspaper, someone basically say, read my review of Pearl Harbor tomorrow or whatever, because I'm going to shit all over it. You know, literally.
Yes!
That, you know, and now there's an element of that. I think you could see that with Wii Music. The basis, this is, you know, the game to, you know, shit on because, it's, you know, we don't like it. It's too casual, it's too silly or whatever. Some people are going to hit it hard, you know, to sort of, and it probably will, you know, especially online, there'll be, you know, it'll sort of have a little viral effect, and everyone will want to read the review that really sticks it to Wii Music. You know, I think you can get it happening that way as well.
Take that, Wii Music.
But what is it specifically that at some point a reviewer becomes sort of their expectations of a game or their expectations of what other people are going to think? What tips them over the edge to say, I'm not just going to play this dispassionately. I'm going to actually come into it with an agenda, as you put it, Johnny.
For the same reason that non-reviewers do that. I mean, when it comes down to it, reviewers are gamers. They play games more or less the same way that normal people do. They are normal people. And so for the same reason that a person buys a game, you know, they've pre-ordered it 6 months ago based on the hype, they pick it up at the store, they take it home, and they basically convince themselves to like it, whether or not it's actually good. I mean, if they took it from a totally neutral perspective going in, they would probably hate it. But they convince themselves that they love it because they've paid for it, right? Reviewers can basically succumb to the same thing even if they don't pay for the game. I mean, if they have convinced themselves that they're really excited about this game, they can go into it and undergo exactly the same thing. And in some ways, that's useful because, again, you want to read a review that will speak to you.
Yes,
you know?
And if you are in the same boat, you have the same expectations, you have the same emotional investment, if you want to put it that way, into the game before it's released, then perhaps it is actually informative. And there's another case that says it's not just myopia or silliness, but it's that in fact, if you have certain expectations coming into a game, that's actually the context in which you enjoy it. And context is very important for how you enjoy anything.
Absolutely.
I mean,
you mean like Rock Band and, like, say, a fan of Guitar Hero and Rock Band reviewing Wii Music and expecting it to be like
precisely.
Guitar
Hero.
Precisely.
I mean, if you have certain expectations of Wii Music and you view it to this guy, this isn't what I want at all. And it's like, well, why would you think it would be? But perhaps some people will bring that baggage. I mean, for me personally, I had quite a strong experience with this again in the film with The Matrix. The Matrix was a sort of sleeper hit in America in terms of it kind of caught fire. and then like, but like, right. by the time it came,
really no hype.
Yes,
before it
by
came
the time
out.
It came to Europe, it had an enormous amount of hype attached to it, and there was a lot of reviews that this is the best sci-fi movie with since Blade Runner and all that. So I'm expecting, you know, Blade Runner or something, and what I get is a cross between anime and John Woo going mental. And you know, I was like, "What the fuck is this? This, you know, this is Blade Runner." Like, you know, but you know, that actually hurt my enjoyment of the film at the time, because if I just is going to be balls to the wall action, you know, and it's going to be done in ways that you haven't necessarily seen before, I said, "Oh yeah, I'd like to go and see that," and you'd enjoy it for what it is. And I think the Wii Music Rock Band parallel operates there as well, in terms of you have to really. The thing, funny thing is, I seldom read film reviews anymore because I like to be surprised. But with games, I like to know what I'm getting. Very much so.
It's a bigger investment. Yeah.
Well, there's certainly for a moment, that part of it. For a moment, I'd like to talk about Twilight Princess, because I think it's a great game to show how, you know, you have expectations, the reality of your experience, and how things kind of flop back and forth. Twilight Princess had to be a 10. Before it came out, it was like, all right, it's the launch title of the Wii. It's going to be the new landmark title in this series. It's a Zelda game. It has to be a 10. It's a 10. It was a 10 before it shipped.
It's the sequel to Ocarina of Time.
It's the second coming of Ocarina of Time.
Exactly. Johnny, I think you gave it a 10. And,
I did, I can't say if I would give it the same if I played through it again, but I'm a different person now than I was 2 years ago, and I've played more games now. And at the time, I believe that was the correct score. Sure. And I'm not going to go back and say I was wrong. At the time, I was right.
Again, it's context. Absolutely. I mean, it's like, you know, some of these scores
very much.
The Dreamcast games got at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, jeez.
Let me go back to the pretty dysfunctional behavior going on there, but some of it is simply in the context of the time. That it was.
Sure, and let me go back to Wii Music, for instance. I remember after E3 this summer, on forums, on our own Nintendo World Report forums, on the GAF forum, I would go into these threads, people were asking about it, and I had actually played the game at E3, so I thought maybe my input would be useful or interesting to these people. And what I found is that there were already, you know, there were plenty of people who basically already decided that they hated it, you know, because they didn't like the idea of it. And there were also a large number of people who decided that they loved it, and there's nothing you could say that would convince them otherwise. And, you know, I read a lot of posts that basically paraphrased to, I don't care what you say, I'm going to buy this, I'm going to love it.
Well, yeah.
And what I replied to them is, I hope you do, and I hope you have a great time with it. If you've already convinced yourself, if you've already hypnotized yourself into believing that it's great no matter what the game actually is in reality, then that's wonderful. I wish you a happy life in your fantasy land, and I hope you stay there. But for those of us who actually have critical thinking and actually react to what is presented to us and not just, you know, put our own opinions over that preconceptions, it does matter whether the game is good or not. And I thought, having actually played the game, and, you know, it was a small closed-off E3, there weren't that many people who actually got to play it. So I figure maybe if I go in there and I can answer some people's questions, I can give them my impressions. I didn't like the game. Mm-hmm. And when I said that I didn't like the game, out of context, a lot of people jumped on me and said, how do you know? You're just like all these other stupid haters. You haven't played. I said, actually, I have played it. I did not like what I played.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was fun. I thought it sounded like shit. I am coming from a place of knowledge here, okay? And yet people still would ignore me or just didn't believe me or wanted to argue with me. And I said, look, you can't argue with me. I don't like it. You know, I can argue with you because you haven't played it. You're ignorant. And I say that with no negative connotation there. Yeah. I'm not saying you're a bad person. You have not played the game. Therefore, you cannot tell me that it's good. I have played the game. I can tell you what I played was not good. See, we're on a completely different level here. And it's hard to have a discussion there when the other person has basically already decided what they think.
Well, I think the problem with it as well is the reason for some of this zealotry is because people internalize these things as an attack on a game that they've spun some narrative that they like or it's going to be good, somehow becomes an attack on them. And therefore, there's no you know, I mean, obviously if someone just come up to you, you know, said something extremely discourteous to your face, you wouldn't just say, well, I respect your opinion. And that's
but you're a douche.
That's the problem, is that, you know, that to them, that's what you're doing. You're not offering a rational take on a game. You're actually, you know, saying something about them or something, and they react badly. But it brings on the issue of pedigree, I think, is really interesting. Like, because obviously one of the things attached with Wii Music at the end of the day, however negative some of the reactions were to it, people say, well, you know, Miyamoto's behind it. Nintendo's behind it. You know, how bad can it be? Look at
it. It must
pedigree.
Be amazing. Yep.
Well, right. But this carries with it good and bad things a lot of the time. I mean, first of all, you've got the situation with Too Human. A lot of the hype's around it because it was Silicon Knights, because they had done good things.
Their past three games were all excellent. You've got Legacy of Kain: Blood Omen for PC and PS1, and then Eternal Darkness, and then Twin Snakes, which I still think is great. You know, I think
this is why when Dennis makes some of the proclamations that he makes, people don't dismiss it out of hand and say, well, you know, this is just like, you know, blast processing or something. You know, this is somebody who's made good games and he's making this game and you should listen to it. And then at some point that turned against him. And that's kind of interesting. Why do you think that happened? Was it just the length of the development and the sense that people got a sense?
I think it's
actually
very dangerous to apply the auteur theory to video games, because the staff required to make the average video game is larger than the staff required to make a film. And by that, I mean, if you look at the credits for Indiana Jones 4, it's 200 people, okay? But 30 people were doing the running the boom mics and stuff. I mean, stuff that has very little to do with the artistry of the game. They're just crew, right? They're paid hourly wages. They're in the union, right? On a game, you've got people doing the programming, the design, the art, the music. I mean, there are very few people on a game development staff who aren't directly involved with the game in some way. Mm-hmm. And so I tend to think that games require more people working in unison to create than something like a film or an album does. And so I think the auteur theory really does not apply very well to gaming.
See,
and that's why it's very dangerous to look at someone like Dennis or Peter Molyneux or Miyamoto and just assume that their next thing... I mean, Miyamoto's games aren't consistently high quality because of Miyamoto. He comes up with the basic idea. He's a project manager, okay? Nintendo's games come out consistently high quality because of the development environment that they've got. It's a corporate mentality, and it's a very robust system that they developed over 30 years of creating games.
I mean, if anything...
It's not just that he has this amazing personality or that he micromanages every single thing that has his name attached to it, because I can tell you with things like Wii Music, he's not that involved with it. He may have had the initial idea, but he didn't produce that game, he didn't direct that game, he didn't design that game.
Well, the thing
he basically said, let's make a music game with the Wii Remote that doesn't require you to, like, play the notes exactly right.
Let's make a music game that's not really music.
Well, the thing is, what
and he has some oversight.
You have to realize what these people are used for now, more so than ever, is
sexy parties.
Well, the whole thing is, I mean, they're used to sell games. I mean,
yeah,
they're used as an endorsement.
Yeah,
is what they're using.
The figurehead element too, and of course you've got this peculiar thing with Assassin's Creed, where you had Jade Raymond being sort of trotted around.
Yeah,
as a producer.
Right.
Here's the thing: Jade Raymond probably had more input into that game than Miyamoto has in most of the games that his name is attached to.
Exactly.
Think of like Mario Galaxy. If you ask a random gamer who made Mario Galaxy, they'll tell you Miyamoto. That game was made on the other side of the country from Miyamoto.
He
didn't have that much to do with it. I mean, he created the character, and he's technically
apparently
the head of the studio
of EAD.
Of Nintendo,
didn't he pick the leadership for Tokyo EAD?
Well, yeah, maybe he did 5 years ago. But, yeah, I'm not saying that he's not involved, but his direct artistic involvement in these games is minimal. Mm-hmm. There's no way he could be involved with this many projects.
But he does the press tour.
No, he's a general manager at this point. He's upper management. I mean, it's just
Who's in charge of Tokyo EAD? Shimizu and Koizumi?
Koizumi,
correct.
So I think you could apply that to Koizumi then, was the auteur, if you want to call it that, for Super Mario Galaxy.
But he gets no credit.
Because his name isn't as marketable. If you want a parallel to the film industry, you had that movie that came out a couple months ago, Righteous Kill,
which is a De Niro and Pacino are they made the movie, like, you know, they are the figurehead of that movie, even though I don't even remember the name of the director, but he made that in like 8 minutes and both of them were shit movies. And
yeah, I mean, if De Niro had directed it, it might have been sort of good.
Yeah, but that aside, I think that, and I think Johnny, when you say something like, you know, the direct involvement of people who work on video games isn't comparable to the direct involvement of people who work on movies, I think that's false. I think that if you were to look at something, you know, even the people who hold the boom mics, that is directly affecting your experience. If that boom mic isn't in place and it's not picking up correctly, the sound is going to
sound
like shit.
Well, I think what's true is that they're both fundamentally collaborative efforts.
Exactly.
And, yes.
You know, and I think that
I mean, there are differences, but the fact they are these huge collaborative efforts,
it all comes together.
From,
and I think
it's certainly different from the scale of albums. Or,
I think even more so with a film, you have people. You know, with a film, you only get one chance. Not only get one take, but as in what you show is one shot at it. So it's all got to be exactly right.
It's got to be straight.
With a game, even, yeah, there's bugs, and, you know, things can go either way, but at the same time, there are variables with a game. It could go this way. Something bad that would ship with the game might not actually affect a player. If something bad shows up in a movie, it's there for you to see.
In perpetuity.
I think that you can definitely compare directly, you know, film auteurs to video game auteurs. It's just kind of like, you're just kind of flipping it on its head a little. You're just kind of
shifting it over. The thing is, when we're dealing with the expectations realm, the fact is we're not really dealing about what really happens. We're dealing with perception.
Exactly. If you're going to make the comparison to film, I would say it's things like when you have like these martial arts movies coming to America and it says Quentin Tarantino presents.
Yeah. Yeah.
He had fuck all to do with the creation of that movie.
Oh, absolutely.
But his name is well known.
He saw the movie and
people
said,
understand
yes,
his
I'll
taste
pay money
in movies.
To release this movie.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing as Ubisoft.
Tarantino is a weird character in that his taste is as well known as his talent.
Mm. Sure.
So people know the kinds of movies that he likes, and so if he presents it, it gives you some preconception of what the movie might be like.
It's really no different than
Ubisoft. It's no different than Ubisoft saying, okay, Ubisoft presents No More Heroes. Ubisoft had dick all to do with that game, but it's still Ubisoft published game.
Does that make it sound worse? Are you trying to prove a point by contradiction here?
James, let it go.
I want to spin this around to something like No More Heroes. An interesting point, because with Suda, you've got the Tarantino parallel is not entirely coincidental in the sense that you know, people will have very definite expectations at this point of what a game is going to be like if Suda is attached to it.
Right. Well, I think I'm not sure you could say that though. I'd say they have very definite expectations that they have no idea what the fuck.
Well,
expect.
but that in itself is
very quirky.
It's going to be something
violent.
It's going to be some sort of irreverent sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be, but that's going to have a lot of sort of otaku culture mixed in with sort of ultra violence and this sort of thing. Maybe the occasional
self-referential,
all that kind of stuff.
What happens if Suda releases a cute 2D platformer for DS?
That's the point. See, but this is what I was going to say. This is true. I mean, I think that's the point I was going to make. With somebody like Suda, where people have Miyamoto's bread so thin, it's kind of like a brand, and you just expect the general Nintendo kind of fun away. Something very specific like Suda's like, so what do you, if he does something that's off the wall and all that, do people actually accept it better because they've got a better idea of if it was not Suda and someone never heard of did exactly the same thing?
Ask Kevin Smith, because he made a movie called Jersey Girl, which I haven't seen it, but I've heard quite a few people say it's actually a good, cute, chick flick, basically. But because Kevin Smith made it, everybody hates it
because it's not like the other stuff he's done.
Kevin
Smith movie.
It's not dog.
Right. It defies your expectations, and that's why it would be really dangerous when you have somebody who has this well-defined style.
The thing to me is that you've got to, if you could have the same exact experience as something like No More Heroes, but it doesn't have Suda attached to it, so you don't have people carrying the sort of the remnants of Killer 7 to it, they might be more baffled by it and actually not enjoy it as much.
Well, I think you could say that if somebody went back and played one of his earlier games, like Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
They would be kind
of, Michigan. I've never heard.
I think they wouldn't see it as his game. I think they'd be kind of surprised.
I disagree. But that's for a whole different reason. It wouldn't be pertinent to the topic. But you know, as far as it's, like I said, I could get into it. But what's the point?
As far as expectation goes, like I said, I was trying to make this point earlier with Twilight Princess, is that I think that when a game is in kind of its preview stage, when it's getting shown around a lot, it's almost unanimously positive. I mean, you have something like Fallout 3, for example, which has been getting tremendously positive reception since basically it was shown off. But now that it's actually coming out, I've been hearing a lot of different criticisms for it. And so I think right now we're in that stage where the public perception could vastly differ by the time the reviews come out. But the thing is,
do you think that most of that, obviously previews tend to be pretty benefit of the doubt-ish, you know?
Right.
Obviously, we've had exceptions like with the Assassin's Creed 1-Up episode.
With Twilight Princess, Evan and I and a few other people caught a lot of shit for making criticisms of Twilight Princess in 2006 when they showed it for Wii for the first time. Serious problems with the controls and with other aspects of it. And some of that was tightened up. You know, some of it they fixed.
This is where the expectations game comes in, because something like Fallout 3 is going to get a lot of the benefit of the doubt when it's got the Bethesda Oblivion pedigree behind it. I mean, that's a lot of the reason.
So you kind of got three stages. You've got pre-release hype, which, you know, can run the gamut from this is going to be fucking awesome, or you have a Too Human episode where people are like, this is going to be terrible. Then you have the release where you have the actual reviews that come out, and that, again, that could go one way or another. But then afterwards, you kind of have that 8 months to a year after the road where kind of the hype is kind of moot at this point. It doesn't really matter one way or another. And I think that's when you get the clearest depiction of if a game is actually good or not. Mm-hmm.
Of times it is months after release before you can really, everybody settles down and sobers up, and finally you can get some consensus on how good is this game really. You know, now that you've played it, you've justified your purchase, you've actually seen it thoroughly. Now, you know, the PR people have left it far behind and they're no longer shilling it. Now you can kind of really take a look at it. And it's kind of one of the sad things where, you know, in our industry, there's an expectation that, you know, if you're looking forward to a game, you want to buy it the first day it comes out. You want reviews to be there before it comes out. Yep. And so it puts a lot of pressure on the industry, on the press, and on the consumers to make up their minds as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And you end up making these snap judgments that sometimes you look back later on and you might regret a little.
Well, the entire review process hinges on that. I mean,
I think what Johnny brings up is a really good point, because the more that the judgments have to be snap and all that, the more the expectations play into it. The more that, you know, stuff like, you know, Halo 3, MGS 4, GTA 4, after the fact, there's been a lot of, you know, did they get over reviewed kind of thing? But
because
it's like everyone's competing to get that first review of GTA 4 that confirms to everyone that it is the second coming.
The whole thing is, all of these games are so-called event games, and I think that it's very easy for reviewers to get caught up in the event.
Consumers get caught up in it as much as reviewers do.
As much as anything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where the
expectation, because that convergence between, well, you have to decide how good the game is right now without having had time to play it necessarily to the fullest extent, if it's a very deep and long game,
to
mull over the consequences of it all for any length of time. It's, you know, bang bang, and those preconceptions that come into it are gonna be a big part of it.
Look at a game like Perfect Dark Zero. Perfect Dark Zero got nines when it came out. Nines, 9.5.
In retrospect, that's a great,
everyone is almost unanimous about, like, okay, this game isn't really that great.
Yeah.
Yep, great example.
But, I mean, the weird thing was, at the time when it came out, there was a pretty strong concept that this game wasn't that great, which makes the fact that it got those ads, those scores, kind of surprising.
Perhaps.
I think it can also happen the other way, too, where sometimes a game comes out, and because it defies your expectations, it gets negatively... You know, it has negative opinions about it, not just reviews, but the consumers
have
this bad feeling about it.
Yeah, that's especially true in the
pre-release. You can look at things like Metal Gear Solid 2, ActRaiser 2. These are games that are significantly different than the game that came before them, and so people, you know, that had a kind of violent reaction to it at first, and then years later you can look back on it and say, you know, actually there are a lot of redeeming qualities here that people kind of overlook because they were upset.
Sure. Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of some more recent examples, I think Wind Waker is definitely one where people hated Wind Waker at first. Sure. Yeah.
But even after Wind Waker was released, there was the big criticism of, you know, the Triforce Hunt, which is
almost, you know.
Well, I mean, it's a valid criticism. How much you want to say that takes away from the demerits of the game, demerits the game entirely is, I mean, it is what it is, and it's not good, but how much that really compromises the entire experience is debatable to me. And I mean, I think
Assassin's Creed probably could fit into that, where there was a lot of real harshness on it early on.
That was just polarizing, wasn't it? You know, it's because IGN.
It was,
but kind of not.
I think hype can be polarizing. Some people buy into it, some people don't, or some people form a particular expectation, whether intended or not, by the marketeers, and some people don't, and so they end up with very polarized views of it.
I think not even that. I think it could be that some people form a particular, you know, reaction to the hype and accept it, and then people form this very adverse reaction because of it.
Exactly. Some people want, there's this internalization issue. There's an identity element to it. So some people will see other people buying in to the hype and say, I don't want to be associated with them, so I'm not going to buy into the hype.
Right.
Essentially, you know.
I'm going to reject it.
Yeah. And certainly Too Human, I think there was a tipping point where, you know, it kind of went from one to the other over the years until it kind of exploded right at the end there, and it was kind of more overwhelmingly in the counter category.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we can lay a lot of the blame on Dennis himself in the case of Too Human.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because he really interfered directly with the marketing of the game, with the publicity of the game on a grassroots level, on internet forums and loads of interviews. I mean, he did an interview with us about Too Human. We don't even cover Xbox.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. That was kind of weird.
Yeah, at that point we thought it was coming out closer to that time than it eventually did, but it wasn't exclusively about Too Human, but we definitely needed to talk about Too Human, or else they weren't going to do the interview, and I wanted to do it anyway because, again, you know, it used to be a Nintendo game, so people were still following it, including myself. But basically he got deeply involved in the process on a personal level and then began to criticize the process itself while this was ongoing, without any kind of retrospective on it, you know, without any kind of historical perspective on, you know, what was done well, what was done properly, what was not. He's basically saying, you know, criticizing the process as it's ongoing, and people resented that. And he did it in a very crass, very abrasive manner, especially on Gaff, where he's basically calling people out, telling them they're idiots, and telling them they're not doing it correctly. And then, not only that, but while he's posting on Gaff and trying to get people interested in his game and trying to clear up some of these misconceptions, he's going to other forums and other interviews and criticizing Gaff and saying it's a terrible place and it ought to be shut down.
Yeah.
And that's what got him banned. And he deserved to be banned for that kind of behavior. I mean, you can't – he's biting the hand that feeds him, or in that case, the hand that slapped him. But he, you know, I mean, he put himself in that position, and he probably paid a price for it, in the long run.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But maybe still remains to be seen. But it probably was not the wisest decision, in that case.
Especially going to Gaff.
I don't know. It's
seriously.
Yeah, it's
a bad choice.
Gaff is a minefield. Yeah. It's a minefield. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, our forums are too, for different reasons, yes. Maybe. But
for more special reasons.
No forum is safe. No forum is safe. I mean, really, forums are where this kind of hype lives and breeds. You know,
yes, absolutely.
Because people, they want to talk, and they want to talk about games that are so far out that all they can do is conjecture. They can discuss what's been going on, and then they speculate and they expand beyond what the reality of what actually has been shown. They start to dream about, what if they do this? I hope they do this. And it all builds up, and eventually over time you get this collective consciousness of what this game maybe should be or what people want it to be, and it may be very different from what the game really is by that point.
Yeah.
And when you get the backlash after the game actually comes out, that's usually where it happens.
I guess the final thing I want to talk about is, to what extent does it become a point that actual game development itself is engineered with these things in mind? Do you get a greater conservatism with big projects like a Twilight Princess? You know, the Wind Waker experience. Little bit, you know, not as positive as they would have liked. Let's give people what they expected originally, and we'll give it to them, and they'll love us for it. And then you could look at maybe, you know, some of the other, you know, the big releases like a GTA 4 or this sort of thing. That it's like, well, let's play this down the line, because if we do mess with it, we could, you know, you've got some that's very bankable. If you've got positive expectations and you generally deliver on those, you're fine. Whereas if you try and go too creative or too off in another direction, you risk, you know, mucking that up. And then, I mean, the DQ9 example, for instance, isn't, I don't know a lot about this, but isn't it true that at one point they were going to have it be quite different?
Yep.
And then they've capitulated on that entirely, and now it's going to be exactly like every other Dragon Quest
game
ever made.
The combat
made.
System is going to be very, it was going to be real time, I believe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there you go. You see it in practice right there. That these things, and that's actually something that you could see explicitly with a change course. But I mean, earlier in the planning stages, these sorts of things must happen where certain ideas are basically stricken. On the basis that we don't want to upset people's expectations, because ultimately it could interfere with the science.
With the Dragon Quest IX example, I think there are a couple of things to consider that may complicate it. First, we don't know that the reason they changed the combat was because of the public outcry.
No, we don't know. Absolutely not.
It may have just not been fun. You know, maybe they did some more testing and figured they couldn't do the rest of the game. The other thing I would say is, even if they did do it as a reaction to the public reaction to that news, you could still say it was a compromise, because it's still an online game, which is it's completely different from anything they've ever done in Dragon. There's not even a multiplayer Dragon Quest game.
Yeah.
So this is still a significant step, I don't want to say forward, it's a step away from the formula. And in a series known for sticking very closely to formula over the course of 8 games, I mean, Dragon Quest VIII is functionally the same as Dragon Quest I.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So, I mean, the series has not evolved very much.
And
that's the way people like it.
And you have
like
to think
so.
that tether to the popularity of Dragon Quest has been a pretty big part of that.
Of course.
Just haven't
people
wanted to upset the balance there.
They have an expectation of what they want. And so if you're going to make changes, you have to be careful about
how you do it. And of
course,
I suppose, I mean, the analogy in the more Nintendo is Pokemon. You know, that maybe that's why we've never seen anything more ambitious from Pokemon. They just keep basically remaking the same game over and over again. Mm-hmm. Because
it's exactly the same situation.
It's just so bankable that you don't want to mess around with that. And because we have seen with Wind Waker, you know, to some extent, and plenty of other games where if people have an idea of something, and at some point they actually believe that they're entitled to it, and so if you take it away from them, that's unfair.
You know, the negative hype about Wind Waker mostly went away before the game actually came.
There was a process where it became more. There was an acceptance, I think. You know, over time.
Exactly.
Without doubt.
But that game actually sold considerably better than Twilight Princess did. So I think in this case, Nintendo going back to the more conservative approach of let's make it look like Ocarina of Time, which people seem to want, or at least some very vocal people say that they want us to go away from these cartoon graphics. It kind of backfired on them, and you know, there may have been other reasons, splitting the SKUs and other elements involved there, but the by far the most successful Zelda game in the past 10 years since Ocarina of Time was Phantom Hourglass, which is pretty strange. It's not a conservative sequel at all. It's pretty far out there.
Certainly quite different from what they did with New Super Mario Brothers. I suppose the way they could couch it is just in the more general kind of perception of the DS platform. That was the way that they could kind of, that people were prepared for it.
Yeah.
Because when you're on a platform like the DS, there's always the possibility that you could have something that's pretty radically different from what you've had before. And there had been good examples of that, like Kirby Canvas Curse, which isn't that much like other Kirby games, but it's very good. So I think people were probably a little more accepting of it in that case. But I think it just goes to show that, you know, these sorts of there's an interesting feedback loop between the developers who want to drive expectations on the one hand, but they're actually beholden to them on the other. That it is very much a circular
process. Of course.
And
yeah,
that no one's
absolutely
really in control. It's a system. It's an identity.
Yeah, and that's why people cling to this auteur theory of game development, because it shows it gives you the hope that someone in the studio is brave enough to have a vision and say, you know what, I know what's best for this, and I'm going to do it, and I'm not going to listen to anybody tell me no.
Yeah.
Well, I think that if you're going to this include Miyamoto as an auteur. I think of all the things he does, that might be his most auteur.
I think he used to be an auteur. I think he's now more of a Tom Clancy.
Well, I mean, I think there's still the real possibility that he could walk into a development project and basically tell them, no, this is
wrong.
Absolutely
could.
Do it like this.
Mythology, he has veto power.
Ending of the tea table.
Of the tea table.
Well,
he basically has veto power.
How much of that is legit?
We do know that it did happen one time.
Well, I think he would do that. Honestly, he would have that on every single project, because obviously every single project would have to go through an executive review before it even gets approved.
Him,
correct.
Whoever,
and you know, I mean, Yamauchi used to basically have that
position.
Yamauchi
was batshit crazy.
I know.
What do you mean?
Yamauchi,
the guy's still alive.
Well, he used to have
well,
final approval
speaking,
over Nintendo
alive.
Games, and he didn't even play
now,
games.
Whatever. That's all good.
He was a robot then.
He's actually the Godfather.
He really is.
Dude is scary. Dude is very frightening.
Yeah. I think Yamauchi's going to come in and, you know, they're going to be telling him, oh, this economic crisis, you know, you can't expect us to keep paying you those huge dividends on the shares. And he's like, there are two things that are recession-proof. Certain aspects of show business and our thing. That's what he's going to say to him.
Yeah.
Soup.
But you know what's amazing about him in particular is how I'm pretty convinced that he said he would just be a completely terrible person to work under. But
I think there's a lot of evidence of that.
He would be infinitely more terrifying to be like a competitor against, because he's the kind of person that I could see doing like old style competition where they actually try to kill you.
Yeah. Although I guess
better on your side than for the other guy.
Yeah.
Right?
And either side is very
spectacular
enticing.
Sort of ascent since Iwata has perhaps applied more rational techniques to controlling Nintendo.
He did say something during an interview about one of those movie projects he was working on that Iwata's made him a lot of money, and for that he's thankful. Or something along those lines.
He's a very grateful man. I think we've mischaracterized him in some sort of
way. He still owns like 30 or 40% of Nintendo. Yamauchi. And he's on the board.
Yeah, he is. I mean, he's still a presence there.
Yeah, and he still owns the Mariners.
Yes, he does. And he's still
okay.
He owns a nice chunk of 100 losses. Good for him.
This has nothing to do with hype, so maybe we should cut ourselves off now.
A discussion of Hiroshi Yamauchi, so we'll close on that.
I'm actually impressed by Greg's knowledge of baseball and a terrible, terrible, terrible team right now.
Well, I don't follow baseball, but when you follow the NFL to the extent I do, you can't help but pick it up by osmosis.
There you go. Okay, so that's going to end our episode, and we want to thank Greg for organizing the feature, and Carl for showing up and being our guest today. James,
no
for
problem.
Editing week in and week out, a very, very difficult job, and John for being so awesome and bald.
Oh, dude.
Now, Johnny, I have one little request before we go. Is that okay?
Yeah.
I have but one request, and that is to pimp my new podcast. It's not a video game podcast. It's not a competitor. I love
You're so
our
banned.
Fans. You should listen to it every week. I'm sorry.
So
I'm sorry. It's actually it's a very general purpose podcast. It's called Talk 112. That's TAWK-112. It's on iTunes. Figure it out. On the first episode, which was last week, we talked about like the CERN hydrogen conductor. We reviewed Mercer President. I think it's really kind of an anything and everything kind of podcast. I think it's pretty interesting if you're into that kind of stuff.
And it's Talk with a W.
Yeah.
Talk with a W, exactly.
Talk.
Okay. Yeah. It's on iTunes. If you want to take a gander at it, you're more than welcome. By the time this episode comes out, we should have – the second episode should be out, maybe even the third one. I don't know. Check it out. And if you like it, listen. Thanks.
There you go. You have more than earned the right to plug your new podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Donnie. Yeah. Thank you.
Don't feel bad about that. And before we go, I just want to remind everyone, if you have any comments or questions about anything we discussed today or anything else in the world of video games, and especially Nintendo, you can send that to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and there is a very high likelihood that we will read it on an upcoming episode.
Or not.
And
so thanks for listening, and we'll...
Dig
a podcast.
You
guys let me on the show. You guys
really
plug a podcast. I won't say the URL, but dig it.
Oh, come on.
There we go.
Well, if you wanted to find it, it would be dig.com/podcast/radio_free_Nintendo_MB3, and you know, whatever.
There you go. Yeah.
Whatever.
You can also get the link in the article for this episode. So there you go. All right. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye,
everybody.
See you on the side.
Stay tuned.
There's nothing here. Why are you still listening?
You take the piss out of Stay Tuned. It could be worse. It could be if you just tuned in.
If you just tuned in.